Hello, everybody. Jan Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. Welcome to a very special LinkedIn Live, what we now call Office Hours. And with me today is Jeff Pfeffer. And Professor Pfeffer is the Thomas D. Professor of Organizational Behavior at the Graduate School of Business, Stanford University, where he's taught there since 1979. He's the author of 16 books, including Dying for a Paycheck, Leadership BS, The Human Equation, Power, Why Some People Have It, Some Don't, and his latest, and this is the one we're going to talk about today, it's The 7 Rules of Power, Surprising but True Advice on How to Get Things Done and Advance Your Career. And before I ask you to, what I didn't put in there, Jeffrey, is if everybody could just let us know where you're listening in from. We'd love to know where your location is, wherever around the world. And Jeffrey, welcome to Office Hours. And what did I leave out of the bio that you think is significant and important?
I don't think you left anything out. I think it's fine. The title of the book is 7 Rules of Power, not the 7 Rules of Power, just 7 Rules of Power. Pretty simple. Okay.
Good.
And it's great to be with you. I'm honored to be part of this, and hopefully we'll have questions from the audience and a lot of interaction so we can, you know, remove a lot of the myths about power.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. You and I first spoke in July 2016. You did a telephone interview with me, which I was very appreciative. And in 2018, you were on the Leadership Podcast with my co-host, Jim Vassilopoulos. And here we are 4 years later. The world is in some ways hasn't changed a bit, and then in the last 4 years has changed a lot. What we want to accomplish today, for those of you listening in, is we really want you to understand power, why power dynamics remain largely unchanged both over time and across cultures and subgroups, and lastly, understand how we get out of our own way and how we might do things differently. So, Jeffrey, as I read your book, which was amazing, and I love everything you've written, and there's so many people we've had on the podcast that have interacted with you and reference you. And of all the people that I reference in my own coaching, I probably reference you more than anyone. And you know, we talk about power, and I'm wondering, you know, you've said, hey, it's the last dirty secret or the secret to success. Well, it's both. Don't blame the tool for how some people use it. Why, you know, at the beginning of your book, you spend a lot of time selling, you know, why this is so important. Why do you think it is we need to get sold on the fact that, you know, power is such an important way to get what you want, to advance your career?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that question because, of course, I think power is important, and it's been important for decades, and it's and is really key. So it's hard for me to know why it's, I think, hard to get people to pay attention to it. I do think you've already alluded to, I think, one of the answers. As Roosevelt Cantor said many years ago, power is the organization's last dirty word. I think power is a tool. It is oftentimes used in difficult or not necessarily the most positive ways. And so people, I think, associate the use of the tool with the tool itself. You can take a hammer and build a house. You can take your hammer and hit someone over the head with it. That doesn't make the hammer good or bad. You can use power to do all kinds of wonderful things, or you can use it to do all kinds of terrible things. And just because it's used oftentimes in malign ways does not make power something that people don't need to understand. But people tend to associate power with maybe some of the people who use it that they don't like, or maybe they associate it with some of the ways in which it's been used, which aren't very nice. I have no idea, but power is a component of virtually all social relations, and it is something that is certainly omnipresent in organizations.
Yeah. And just so the audience knows, I just put a note out there. Your questions are welcome. Jeffrey asked at the very beginning, you know, let's make this interactive. If you have questions, we'll do our very best to get those up there and get those answered. And some of you already put in some pre-questions, which I've got on my list here to get to. So please let us know. So Jeffrey, I've been admonished here and there for using power and referencing your work, and people will come back and say, why aren't you talking about influence? Power is such an abrasive word. You know, and I know you've worked with Bob Cialdini, who wrote the book on influence. So, I mean, what would you say to that, you know, using those words and what the nuances, the differences might be?
Well, you know, I think many people want to use language that makes things look nicer than they are. So no one dies anymore. They age out, or they, you know, there's all kinds of euphemisms for everything. To me, power is potential. So you can have power. When you use that power, it becomes influence. So influence, for me, the definition of influence is just power in use.
And, you know, influence in use. And let's just dive into the
that influence puts power in use. So power is potential, you know, like you got a voltage on an electric current, or, you know, or whatever, you got some charge in a capacitor. When you release that charge through an electric current, like amperes, then the electrical potential becomes actual electricity. So you store electricity in a battery, then you use it, you build up power, and then at some point you use it, it becomes influence.
I got it. That's the best definition I've heard. Thank you. So let's jump into the seven rules that you've got. The first one is get out of your own way. And a lot of what I heard in that chapter was, you know, it's about self-confidence. It's about positive self-image. It's about political skills, resilience, persistence. It even reminded me of that great article in The Atlantic, The Confidence Gap. About, you know, how you carry yourself. You know, you put that one first. I mean, is that one the most important one? Is just getting out of your own, the self-talk?
I believe so. I think, you know, I'm launching a podcast called Pfeffer on Power, which will go live sometime after September. And I'm recording a ton of episodes. And in those episodes, I often hear people talk about, you know, what's in their heads, getting out of their own way, not self-handicapping themselves and going into situations with the idea that they can in fact be powerful. So yes, I think, you know, I mean, you're not likely to use any of the other rules of power if you to somehow, you know, don't think it's appropriate for you, or don't think you deserve it, or don't think you can do some of the things you need to do. So I think getting rid of the self-talk is very important. And Jan, you would know that from your coaching work. I mean, certainly as you see and work with people, a lot of, I suspect, what you do is getting them out of their own way, getting them to stop engaging in various forms of self-apology, self-handicapping, self-doubt, self all the other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And self-sabotaging. And in that chapter, you talked a lot about minorities and women, and how that's the same and how it's different. And any, you know, and again, that was one of the pre-questions that we got was, you know, how might that be different for people that aren't, you know?
Well, you know, I think minorities and women, or underrepresented minorities, African-Americans and women, are very likely to have been given, maybe by their parents or certainly by society, a set of ideas about what they deserve, a set of ideas about what is appropriate for them to do and what is inappropriate for them to do, and that they're not supposed to display anger, and they're supposed to, you know, get along and all this other stuff. And the example I use in that chapter, I believe, is my friend Laura Esserman, Time Magazine, 100 Most Influential People in 2016, winner of the Stanford Business School Arbuckle Award, a force of nature. And she really does not, when she came to my class once, I said, Laura, you don't act like a woman. You know, women aren't supposed to get angry, you get angry. Women aren't supposed to swear, you swear. Women aren't supposed to use the F word, you do. And she sent me an email, which I quote in that chapter, in which she says, I will not let other people define what I can and cannot do. And I think that's exactly right, that you do not want to have, you know, you may be a a woman or an African-American woman or whatever, don't let the world define what is appropriate for your behavior. Don't let the world put you in a box. Don't let the world keep you in a box, which the world would like to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I mean, great counsel. And it, again, it goes in the face of things. I mean, you said, you know, she can show anger. I mean, oftentimes we're taught, hey, we've got to control our emotional response to deliver what's best for the team and be authentic and you know, all those things. And in the book, there's points where you say, you know, sometimes showing anger, an outburst of anger can set a tone that you have power.
Yeah. Yes, you know, powerful people get to be angry. So if you show anger, you have power. And also, I've seen Laura in meetings, and by the time she's finished eviscerating people, they don't mess with her ever again. So, you know, it's wonderful.
Right. Well, and I think, I don't know if you said this, but, you know, that something about being nice or kindness is overrated.
Well, my friend Gary Lubman, okay, who was a Harvard Business School professor, went on to become chief operating officer of Harrah's. Then Harrah's changed its name when it merged with Caesars and became Caesars. He was the CEO of Caesars for about 13 or 14 years. Then he went to Aetna. Now he's running a startup in Boston. And Gary is famous for coming to my class and saying, if you want to be like, get a dog. The dog will love you unconditionally. Your job as a leader of an organization is not to win some popularity contest. It is to get things done. You've been hired. You've been hired to make things happen. And you're not been hired, you know, to be the nicest person in the room. You're supposed to be the most effective person in the room.
Yeah. Well, that goes to the second rule, which you say, break the rules.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering what your favorite story is, you know, about breaking the rules.
Well, I have many favorite stories. First of all, I would recommend people read Malcolm Gladwell's, I think it's from 2009, New Yorker article, How David Beats Goliath. And of course, David beats Goliath by not fighting the battle on Goliath's terms. You see this certainly in strategy, where companies will do different things. They will break, you know, Apple has broken with much conventional wisdom, as has Whole Foods, as has Southwest Airlines. You know, so I think strategically, you do not want to be constrained by the rules. The example I use in the opening chapter, and I just actually interviewed her yesterday for my podcast, is a woman named Christina Troitino, who got herself into a Martha Stewart dinner at the Sundance Film Festival by basically, you know, being bold, asking for things, not following, you know, and getting out of her own head. It was just amazing. I mean, you know, she sent an email. She said, I'm a writer for Forbes. She writes part-time for Forbes. As she pointed out on the podcast, thousands of people write for Forbes. But anyway, she said, I'm a writer for Forbes. Didn't say she was a second year Stanford MBA. You know, and then when the people responded and gave her choices of two dinners to attend, she said she was busy for one, which she wasn't. She took a while to respond, which signaled that she had more power and wasn't that anxious. She showed up at the dinner with her boyfriend at the time, the plus one. She hadn't told him there was a plus one. They let the boyfriend in. Basically, she did what, you know, she did not follow. She was not, in quotes, nice and polite, which is, of course, one of the reasons why she's done well.
Well, you again, a little tactical thing you just mentioned, and some people might relate out there, is you said, you know, don't respond to messages immediately. Yep. And so much of what we think is, oh, the boss called, the boss texts me, I need to be super responsive. You're saying, in some ways, being slow to respond, you know, creates a more power.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's really contrary to conventional thinking. And, you know, the third rule was show up in a powerful fashion. I think the example you used was the Catch Me If You Can movie.
I mean, you know, this idea of fake it until you make it, which I think is actually the wrong phrase. I think the correct phrase is fake it until you become it. You know, I mean, nobody starts off as a professional. Nobody is born a professional tennis player, a professional violinist, a professional, you know, whatever, professor. Nobody's born, you know, a CEO. You, in fact, adapt and grow into those roles. And certainly, you know, when I look at another woman who's been on, who's going to appear on my podcast, Laura Chow, when I look at other people, they will often show up in my class, even as students, but certainly as visitors, dressed better than the typical Silicon Valley, you know, wear as crappy a clothes as you possibly can. They show up. La is from Vietnamese parents, was told, by the way, not to be ambitious, but she's overcome. She's a partner in a VC firm. She's tall. And Asian women typically are not tall. She's a very tall Asian woman. She wears heels. She's 6'1". And as she said, I stand out as basically the tallest Asian woman many people have ever seen. And she dresses extraordinarily fashionably. And so here you have this woman who's, of course, extraordinarily smart and extraordinarily accomplished. But part of her showing up is also her visual image.
Well, we got a comment here from Olivia. And Olivia, thank you for writing. The likability factor, she's saying that's a fact. That I think what she's saying, Jeffrey, is, you know, as a woman, you have to be liked.
You do not have to be liked. You do not have to be liked as a woman. You do not have to be liked as a man. I don't believe Carly Fiorina is winning any popularity contest. I don't believe Meg Whitman, when she ran eBay, was running any popularity contest. I don't think Sarah Palin, who's running apparently for the Alaska House seat, is trying to be the world's most popular woman. I don't think Imelda Marcos, and I highly recommend, oh my God, I recommend The Kingmaker. What an amazing documentary, which predicts or goes earlier in time, the election of her son, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., otherwise known as Bongbong, to the presidency of the Philippines. This is a family which is accused of looting the Philippines of $1 zillion. Imelda Marcos is famous for her shoes. I don't think you need to be liked. And you may think you need to be liked. That's self-handicapping. You need to be effective. Nobody's going to hire you because you're the sweetest person. You're going to get hired, you know, because, and you're going to get promoted because of what you're able to do.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, because we talk about this on the Crucible Expeditions that I run, the whole, you know, do you have to be nice? And one of the things you mentioned in the book is some of the things that you need to do to get to a high position are different than what you need to do once you're in that position. So you can to get power, you might have to behave differently than once you have power.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct.
So maybe sometimes we mix that up a little bit. Here, Olivia's weighing in again. So the vast majority of women in the workforce would face consequences.
It's not clear. There are certainly, we could have a long discussion about this. Certainly the expectations for women is that they're supposed to be nice and communal and warm and, you know, sweet and many other things. But when I look at the women who I know who have been effective, Frances Conley, who unfortunately now has dementia, but was the first tenured neurosurgeon in a medical school faculty. When I look at Laura Esserman, when I look at Dianne Feinstein, our senator, who's unfortunately now have some cognitive impairment. When I look at Amy Klobuchar, the Minnesota senator, who at one point ran for president and her staff said she's not the sweetest person. When I look at Meg Whitman, Carly Fiorina, when I look at other people, again, this is not about being gratuitously nasty or violating my friend Bob Sutton's idea, the no asshole rule, but it is being, I think, strong. And strong women, yes, strong women are not always seen as nice or as conforming to gender role stereotypes. But if you conform to gender role stereotypes, how much power have you given away? And, you know,
I think that's the interesting question. And again, Olivia says, you know, there's HBR research on this, and I get it. But I think what you're saying is, you know, if you conform, You know, how much power are you giving away, or what are you not accomplishing, you know, to conform? And I do think, you know, that applies to, like you said in your book, to different subgroups, not just minorities and women, but other subgroups. Yep.
That's exactly right. And I know the HBR article to which Olivia is referring, it's not, I actually don't agree with it. There is a much more systematic research on the effect of agreeableness on careers. The title of the article is "Do Nice Guys and then hyphen and Gals Actually Finish Last?" It's co-authored by Beth Livingston, which I highly recommend. It shows that agreeableness as a personality dimension is negatively related to salary for both men and women. It is, of course, more negatively related to salary for men. And that's because men are expected to be a little less nice than women. But the effect is true for both men and women, that agreeableness is negatively related to salary. And this is a longitudinal study done over many years. And then they also have some experiments. And they also have a lot of logic about why agreeableness might get in your way, including your desire to be nice and your desire to be liked might lead you to negotiate less hard for salary.
Yeah,
and we know the importance of negotiation, or it might lead you to forestall doing certain things that would give you power, but that would have you perceived as a not nice person.
You know, when I facilitate discussions, one of the ground rules I always have is two things that might sound contradictory. One is hold your views lightly, and the other one is risk saying what you think.
Of course, absolutely.
And you know, we've had 320 guests on the Leadership Podcast, and I can't tell you how many people have talked, you know, we've had on that basically it was all about heart-led leadership, and that was nice. But I'm just, to the audience, I'll say this. What I really love about Jeffrey's work is it's evidence-based. You know, Jeffrey is not throwing out opinions. I mean, he's going to research and data. And again, there's a lot of research and data. And again, I would ask people, you know, hold your views lightly you know, evaluate the evidence. And that's one great thing about the book is there's a lot of evidence. You don't have to agree with it, but we got another question here coming in, and this is from Corbin, and Christian also has the same question. Where do you draw the line between not caring about being liked versus maintaining a professional, courteous relationship? Good question. Well,
I mean, critical relationships have to work, but so my friend Gary Lubman also said, you know, I'll be like a dog, also said that when you're in a senior executive role, critical relationships have to work. You can, you know, make critical relationships work by asking for people's opinion, by flattering them, by spending time with them. But I think, you know, I think maintaining a relationship is different than is different than having people be your best friend.
And I think that's a great response. And I'm just keeping track of all the other questions coming in. Good stuff coming in. Let me go to the fourth rule, Jeffrey. Create a powerful brand. You know, stand out. Self-promotion versus showing impact. Difference is what it takes to get promoted versus traits of someone in power. But you know, that powerful brand, I, as a coach, there's a lot of times when I'm talking about, you know, to people and saying, hey, what do you think your reputation is around here? And you know, what do you want that brand to be intentionally? What do you want people to think when you show up? So, you know, any sort of tactical advice you might have for people?
I mean, so what we do in the class and what we do in the online version of the class is have people build a brand statement, and then we try to give them through the coaches that we use in both versions of the class, give them feedback on that brand statement. An effective brand statement is short, and it is not a resume. It doesn't summarize your educational credentials and your experience. But what it does is it represents what you stand for and how your qualities and characteristics and your background make you uniquely qualified for the job that you want to hold. I can give you an example. There was I have my friend Tristan Walker, on whom I wrote a case who now is at Procter & Gamble, Walker & Company Brands, come to the class. And so one day he was actually there physically before he moved to Atlanta after Procter & Gamble bought Walker & Company Brands. And he's there. And there is this African-American man who hadn't said, by the way, very much during the class. And I called on him. And he said, you know, he said, I'm a physician as well as getting my MBA degree. I come from a very disadvantaged background, you know, from a very poor area of a major urban city in the United States. And my brand is based upon that background and based upon my medical degree. My brand is bringing medical care to underserved communities and doing it in a way that combines my medical training with, you know, with my business school experience to do it in a cost efficient way. And basically that's one sentence. And what struck me about that is that there were people in the class who knew him and they had never known about his background. Some of them didn't even know he was in medical school. Nobody in the class understood, or almost nobody in the class knew what his aspirations were and what he was trying to do. And when he articulated, I am trying to bring medical care to in a cost-efficient, business, you know, savvy way to underserved communities, he now had put himself out there in a way that people could, of course, help him because they actually understood who he was and what he was trying to do. And he didn't give them a 40-minute speech about this, but he had done it with a relatively succinct statement. So branding permits other people to help you because they know what you're about. And branding also, very much like branding for a product, can help build your visibility.
And Jeffrey, a tactical question. How would you differentiate a brand statement for an individual versus something that might be considered a tagline?
I haven't really thought about that, so okay. I can't really. I think a brand statement would be a little bit longer. And it really tries to integrate and answer the question, why are you uniquely suited for the role that you're trying to fill or to the role to which you're aspiring?
Yeah, and that goes back to the self-talk, that uniqueness. We've got another question here from Naomi, and thank you, Naomi. What advice would you provide a person who has quickly transitioned to a senior leadership role and now supervises their previous coworker? Naomi, happens all the time. The power shift here has been challenging, and no doubt. I was there a long time ago. Jeffrey, what say you on this one?
Well, you know, I think there are two issues. As my friend Deb Grunfeld points out in her book, Acting with Power, I think one of the problems that people face is when they get into supervisory roles is to believe they actually deserve to be in that role. So if there's any self-talk or doubt or absence of self-confidence, you want to kind of overcome that and eliminate that. And the other thing I think I would say is you need to maybe dress differently and act differently. You need to speak and act with power.
Speak and act with power. And you know, that goes to the next one, the fifth one. And Naomi, if we answered it, great. If we didn't, please feel free to post a follow-up. The fifth rule, and this one's a tricky one because we all sort of interpret the word networking differently. Your fifth is network relentlessly. Correct. And you talk, you know, it's interesting because you talk about flattery, you talk about bringing people together. And I'm reminded of my junior officer days down south of Hewitt when Monterey had Fort Ord, California, that, you know, we called those people brown nosers and butt kissers and boot shiners. And, you know, it was considered really poor form to, you know, be political, but you'd watch those people that did that and they were the ones getting the nice assignments. And you're like, oh my God.
And by the way, the promotions.
Yeah. But there was a lot of people that said, if that's what it takes, I'm not going to do it.
In that case, they don't have to do it. But anybody can make any choice that you do anything that they want. And, you know, I'm not going to tell any human being how to live their life. But I will tell you that if you don't do what you need to do to get ahead, you can't complain about not getting ahead.
Yeah. Well, And you know, what's interesting, again, networking relentlessly, and I love what you, one of the ways you phrased it, because I think this is so important, is bringing people together.
Sure.
You know, I mean, somebody that, you know, brings people together, whether you're a connector or you actually organize something, but, you know, it does create power and influence. People look at that. There's a Wall Street article the other, about 6 days ago, called "The Price We Pay for Being Less Social." And the subtitle was, "People are choosing to be less connected with each other and focus more on their inner lives. They may not realize the consequences." So, you know, again, with, and something else I saw the other day was, most people are showing up to the office one day a week. So there's this whole big debate about it. But I mean, it kind of, I mean, if I read what you've written, boy, if you want power and influence and want to be able to get resources for your team and clear obstacles, you better be in there rubbing elbows with people and forming relationships and, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, you can certainly form relationships on Zoom. I mean, you don't have to necessarily, you know, be face to face, but you definitely need to spend enough time. I mean, if you think about it, I don't understand why this rule is so controversial, or so whatever. You know, I mean, if management or leadership, or call it what you will, is getting things done through other people, it seems pretty obvious to me that if, you know, that if you're trying to get things done through other people, the more other people you're in contact with, the more other people you have relationships with, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah. Well, it's said perfectly, getting things done through other people. We got a question here from Christian. And again, Christian, thank you for your question. So what is acting with power? Voicing opinions, pushing back if someone disagrees with a strategy? I mean, he's asking for examples.
Acting with power really is a lot around body language. I would ask you to read articles by Dana Carney, who C-A-R-N-E-Y, who's now writing a book on body language. She has an article in California Management Review that summarizes this. She has an article also in a more academic journal. I mean, acting with power is around how you present yourself. It is body language. It includes touching. It includes physical distance. It includes taking up an expansive posture. It includes all kinds of things.
Yeah. And yeah, very. You know, you mentioned touching. And so let me just touch on this. I grew up with a mentor who was always grabbing my forearm. You know, like when he wanted to get your attention, he grabbed your forearm. And, you know, and I sort of grew up that way, that, you know, touching people's shoulders. And now, I mean, there's like, you really got to know your audience a little bit.
You have to know your audience, but I'm not talking about touching in a sexual way. I'm talking in a way one of the things that I have seen some people do, which actually is more effective than you might think, is when they meet people for the first time, but every time they see them, they will shake hands. I mean, shaking hands is touching. It is making physical contact. I don't think anybody, well, I'm sure there's, you know, I can't say anything with a blanket statement anymore, but I don't think, you know, shaking somebody's hand, man or woman, is going to get you accused of sexual harassment. But it does make that physical contact, and it's an act of politeness, and it's really easy to do.
Yeah, I agree. So networking was number five. Number six was using your power. And you made a comment, and I find I say this a lot in coaching, is, well, what matters to your boss? And that was a big thing. And the other thing you mentioned in the chapter is, you know, asking. And I'm reminded, and, you know, when I went through sales training a long time ago, was some people ask for what they want. Some people take what's given to them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those were some of the things that I heard in that chapter, using your power. Any other anecdotes? Or?
Yeah, well, no, I think people, you know, it goes back to a question that was asked a few minutes ago. You know, I think people are oftentimes put in a position and then they're reluctant to actually use their influence to get stuff done. But the more stuff you get done, the more likely it is that people will give you the resources to get things done. People love to be associated with success. So the more you do and the more success you have, the more good people are going to work with you and want to work with you, the more people are going to want to, you know, give you resources, give you training, whatever. So you want to use your power. Power is not something that gets used up. The more you use it and the more effective you are in making things happen, the more power you'll have.
You know, I remember when we spoke in the past, I asked you about leadership and you said, well, something to the effect, well, job one is keeping your job.
Of course.
You know, if you don't have that job, you have no power and influence. You can't take care of your team.
That's correct.
And one of the things you said in the chapter I thought was interesting is if you hold multiple positions, it's harder to get rid of you.
Of course. So, by the way, if you get rid of your opponents, it's harder to get rid of you. So if you look, I mean, you know, this sounds harsh, but you look at, you know, I mean, when new presidents come in, they get rid of all the cabinet people from the old administration, but that goes on in companies as well. You know, the new CEO comes in and he or she will bring in their new team. And so, you know, and that is, you know, Jim Collins has a nice euphemism for it. It's called getting the right people on the bus. But it's the same thing. You want people on the bus with you or in the organization with you in your leadership team who understand what you're trying to do and are supporting you in doing it. You don't want to, so you want to make sure that you have a team of allies.
Yeah. Jeffrey, I think that's such an important point. I can't tell you how many CEOs I've spoken to. And I said, you know, hey, what was the hardest lesson you learned? And almost invariably, they'll say, you know what? I went in, there was a team in place. They were good people. They were smart people. They weren't the right people. And you know what happened? I didn't get rid of them and replace them with people that were loyal to me. And guess what they did?
Yep.
They were my undoing.
Yep, of course. Of course.
And it's like, and again, that's a terrible regret to have because you know in your heart, like, hey, these are my people or they aren't. And it does, you know, again, it does sound harsh, but you're going in, you have a job to do.
That's correct.
And you need the right people around you.
Yeah. And if this were a sports team, there would be no problem. I mean, I said, if you took over running a sports team and you had people on the team who, number one, did not agree with your strategy and weren't going to do it. And number two, did not have the capabilities to execute what you need to do to run the football play or play baseball or whatever sport it is, you would. Sports teams trade people out all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a saying in the special operations community: selection is an ongoing process.
Yes, that's correct.
Because you get to come to the compound today, doesn't mean you get to come back tomorrow.
You have
to make the team.
That's
correct. And you know, businesses don't operate that way, though I often think they should.
Well, some of them do. And by the way, making the team has two components. One, do you have the competence to do the job? But secondly, are you aligned with the vision and the strategy? Because, you take the team of the Budweiser horses, which they use in all those beautiful Christmas commercials. If the horses are all trying to run in a different direction, the wagon that they're pulling isn't going anywhere.
Right. Well, I would add, you said vision, strategy. I'd also add values, the way that in which you work.
Yeah.
Let's go back to networking real quick. We got a question from Kim Ward. Thank you for the question. You can have contact with many people, but if you don't make a lasting impression, does it really count as networking?
As I point out in the chapter, which I hope Kim will read, the most important ties in the world are weak ties. You don't actually have to have strong ties to people. Often I have examples of people who've raised money through people from people that they barely know. There's a difference between, I know Kim Ward, we met once, and Kim Ward is close, and we become very good friends. The difference between weak ties and strong ties is much smaller in operationally than the difference between not knowing you at all and knowing you a little bit. So you just need to be known a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting, Jeffrey. People often ask, you know, how do you get interviews with all these people? And to me, I just ask. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Well, and we live in a world in which I'm desperate to sell books. So,
I appreciate the transparency. So here's another one. Corbin asking, which would you say is more effective for establishing and maintaining power, bringing in a new team or working to establish trust with the existing experienced team?
It depends upon, you know, I mean, that's a question in which I'd have to know who, what the existing team is and whether or not they like you and whether or not they're aligned and whether or not they're competent and whether or not you come from inside or outside the organization. But outsiders typically bring in their own team. And regardless of whether you keep the old people who've been there before or bring in new people, you need to make sure that they are aligned with what you're trying to get done and that they are loyal to you.
Yeah, good. I'm really glad we got a question from this guy. Colonel Andy McIlvain at the National War College, who's getting ready to come into the business world and is super excited because he's going to make a big difference in our world. So Andy is asking, if you stack your team with only loyal allies, do you run the risk of living in an echo chamber? How do you ensure you get accurate feedback as a leader without at least some on the team that are willing to push back?
So that's an interesting question. And I think you want people who are willing to tell you the truth, but who are also aligned with you and loyal to you. I could be loyal to Andy and really love him as a leader and not try to undermine him, but also at the same time, give Andy my honest opinion. However, that question raises to me is what is the biggest obstacle to organizational performance? Is it knowing what to do? In which case, you know, we need to get lots of diverse opinions so we can figure out what is the best answer, or is it execution? And most of the organizations that I've seen, execution is a way bigger problem than figuring out what is the right thing to be executing. I still remember meeting with Hassel Plattner, after whom the Stanford Design Center is named. It's called the Hassel Plattner Design Center. When he was a co-founder of the software company SAP, and I was interviewing him for a case I was writing, not on him, but on somebody else. And he said to me, Jeffrey, you're supposedly an expert on power. He said, I'm a co-founder of SAP, this legendary figure in the computer industry. He said, I can't get people in my organization to do what they need to do, which in his particular case was to design software that was user-centered rather than software designer-centered. And so when I look at organizations, most of them actually know pretty well what the right answer is. They can't get it done. And so therefore, I load more on the, I need people who can execute well rather than I need a bunch of smart people to ask me good questions. Because oftentimes, Bob Sutton and I wrote this book, The Knowing Doing Gap. And the premise of the book is organizations know what to do and they can't do it.
Yeah. It's really interesting, Jeffrey, because I've seen some articles lately. I don't think it's research. It's just some articles and opinions that, for years, decades, we've had kids work in groups, students work in groups and collaborative. And now we're at a point, and I spoke to a brilliant guy I'm coaching today who talked about the cognitive revolution that he thinks we're in. And that in this article posited that we don't need to work together as much as, you know, we thought. There's a lot of things that can be done individually, but then leaders have to get a lot better of when they do bring people together, how they collaborate and facilitate those things that need to be done. And like what you're saying is it might not be on the direction of the organization. It might be on the pace and tone needed for execution.
Yep.
So, all right. Another question here coming at you from Christian. So if you're not in a position of power.
This is a great question. I've already read it.
Okay, good. You're ahead of
the game. Here we go. When Willie Brown, probably the most powerful African-American politician in history, became Speaker of the California Assembly, he did something which I recommend to people all the time, which is called strategic outplacement. You need to make lots of friends with executive recruiters and get people who are in your way great jobs in other organizations.
So that's it.
Just, you know, find them a great job elsewhere. By the way, in academia, we do that all the time. We take bad people from our institution and make them deans other places. You know? But in order to do that, you have to be able to praise them, which you may not feel. But, you know, you can say, wow, this is a, if this person left it, but, you know, if this person left Stanford, I would be crestfallen. I wouldn't even know what to do. My life would be over. But, you know, they would make such a great dean for you.
All right. So now we're on, of the seven rules, we're on number seven. Understand that once you have acquired power, what you did to get it will be forgiven, forgotten, or both.
Yes, sir. And by the way, there's an article in the New York Times yesterday and in TechCrunch yesterday, which you probably know, Adam Newmark, about whom books were written. About, you know, who took WeWork from God knows what to nothing, you know, and took out more than $1 billion of money for himself, is starting a new venture, and he's being funded to the tune of $300 million with a valuation of $1 billion. And I've already made a LinkedIn post about this. It illustrates seven rules of power perfectly.
Yeah.
I also have other illustrations in that chapter, but the Adam Newmark story this is it. You know, he's got a reputation, he's got a brand, he's got money, he's got connections. And the fact that he was flamed out. And by the way, he not only flamed out like many human beings will flame out, you know, he was flamed out in a public way. They wrote books about him. They got like, he's on the news. He's got like this huge brand. Doesn't matter. He's being funded.
Well, it makes me think of Martha Stewart. It makes me think.
Oh, of course. Her brand is never, she served jail time. Her brand has never been worth more. By the way, I'm not recommending you go to jail. It's not a pleasant place. But on the other hand, you know, there is another wonderful example. Or Michael Milken, who also served time, who was introduced. I'm watching some Oakland A's baseball game, and he's introduced as a philanthropist, which of course he is. You know, so I, you know, that's.
Well, that's another great example. Yeah. So, you know, you've done a great, I think this is your fourth book on power. Is that correct?
That's, I believe so. Yeah.
So, you know, and again, the book is chock full of student stories. You know, a student came in reluctant, they pushed back. You saw him in a grocery store. Hey, Jeffrey, this really worked. Now my life, you know, so again,
and by the way, it's not only full of student stories, but it's full of stories of people of color and women. So and by the way, that was not hard to do. I have a coach who works with my class who says that 70% of his clientele is now women and underrepresented minorities, mostly because as the woman on my, Christina Troitino is on my podcast or recording my podcast hasn't gone live yet, Pfeffer on Power. But when she was on the podcast, and many people have said to me, you know, if you're a privileged person, if you're a white guy from a rich family, you don't need to know the rules of power because you're going to win, period. When you are not from a place of privilege, when you are disadvantaged, either because of your socioeconomic status or the expectations you have or where you come from or whatever, or you come from a foreign country or, you know, whatever the particular issues are, then you really need to know the rules of power even more.
Yeah. Well, with these seven rules and all the interactions you've had over a long and storied career, what's the biggest mistake you see? Again, you had 15 minutes to coach someone and you know, what would be the one thing you would say, hey, this is a mistake too many people make, don't make this mistake?
I would say get out of your own way. It's the rule one. I think you need to stop self-handicapping yourself. And many of the questions that we've been asked, they're wonderful questions, but they also, I think, reflect an attitude that says, I don't really want to lean into this. I don't really want to do this. I have some kind of, for reasonable reasons, self-inhibitions. And, you know, when I see the people, both men and women, underrepresented minorities, whatever, that are go the farthest, they are the people that will not stop until they are successful.
Yeah. So Let me shift gears just a little bit. We're getting toward the end. Two books you wrote that that I really liked. One was Dying for a Paycheck, How Modern Management Harms Employee Health and Company Performance. And the other one was Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers One Truth at a Time. So there's billions of dollars spent on leadership development, coaching, workshops, keynote speeches, all kinds of stuff. Yet, you know, we've been saying this for decades, there's a dearth of good leaders. What should be different about the way we develop leaders than what we've been doing?
Yeah. So I went to a CLO, Chief Learning Officer conference in Half Moon Bay. And I said to the people in the room, put your hand up if you have problems with the retention of high potentials. Every hand goes up. I said, keep your hand up if the reason why you have problems with retaining high potentials is that many of them suffer career derailments, and the hands stay up. And then keep your hands up if the reason for the career derailments is that the people who are derailing have insufficient ability to manage organizational dynamics, otherwise known as political skill. Every hand stays up. And then I said to them, keep your hand up if you do training on organizational power and politics. Every hand goes down. And there mm-hmm. it is. So we know that career derailment is common. The Center for Creative Leadership has done research on this. We know that one of the main causes for career derailment is not that people aren't smart or that they're not hardworking. One of the main reasons for career derailment is the inability to manage political dynamics, otherwise known as organizational politics, successfully. And then we do not give people training in this. And then we wonder why leadership training basically doesn't work. It's like saying to you, I'm going to train you in medicine, but I'm not going to train you in the most important skill, whatever that is, that's going to make you an effective doctor. It's mm-hmm. just, to me, this makes no sense. But given that this is run by HR people, I understand.
So what you're talking about, I mean, really is one of the, you know, what Dan Goleman would say, one of the five components of emotional intelligence, the social part. So, Jeffrey, let me ask you something that might be kind of a crazy question. So if you had an organization theoretically and everybody basically developed these skills, had this knowledge, if everybody was operating that way, would there be chaos? Because I mean, everybody would.
No. I think it goes back to an earlier answer. I think the problem in most organizations is insufficient political skill, not too much. And the big problem in most organizations is the ability to get things done. And you can never have too many people with the ability to get things done. And that's what this is about. So I go every year up until the COVID, and now I went back this year to teach in a program at ESA in Barcelona. And the title of the program is Getting Things Done. And a big component of that is, in fact, the power and influence skills.
So that makes me think of another thing. So, you know, a lot of what you talk about is, you know, these things can be good fused for good, or they, you know, you could have good intentions or bad intentions when it comes to acquiring and using power. So is it part of the organization's responsibility to make sure that people are being virtuous, that you're actually talking about some of those cardinal virtues?
I'm not sure that it's certainly not my responsibility to do that. The organizations can do what they want.
Yeah. I think, you know, the organization I work with, one of the most interesting and successful organizations I work with actually spends a lot of time talking about those things. And, you know,
the problem, Jan, is, which I talk about actually in Seven Rules of Power. The problem is that there is no evidence whatsoever that training in business ethics leads to ethical behavior.
I remember that research that you talked about. Yeah.
So it's not clear. I mean, you can talk about whatever you want. It's not clear that it actually does much good.
Yeah, I think what it does, again, I think what it does is at least it creates a common language, a common vocabulary.
Yeah. But people behave according to what they see their leaders doing and according to what they're rewarded for. You know, so if I say to you, you know, you got to do some things and I don't care how you do it, then you're going to do one thing or whatever. But I also think people really underestimate the extent to which execution is the key to success. Yeah. And the ability to get things done, to muster the resources, to muster the influence is really important. And yeah. By my computer clock, it is 10:55. Yeah. I have another call at 11. So we need to close this down.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure what Mohammed is referring to, what the it is, how it impact culture. But I mean, at the essence of everything we're doing, that is it. So, Jeffrey, let me ask you the last question is, what's next in your research?
So I'm writing a book on how on a very different topic, on how, and it should be written, but it isn't, on how companies could fix. Companies pay for more than half of U.S. healthcare. Companies buy healthcare and manage their healthcare benefits in about as incompetent a fashion as can be conceivably imagined. And if companies would do a better job of doing that, they could help fix U.S. healthcare.
So
the working title of the book is No Measurement Plus No Accountability Equals No Performance, which I think describes U.S. healthcare perfectly.
I spent 25 years in the business side of healthcare. There's a lot that could be a whole other show one day. But Jeffrey, hey, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for the work that you're doing. It makes a difference in all our lives. It gives us great things to think about so that we can be more effective. We owe that as a responsibility to the teams we're honored to lead. So thank you for doing the work you do, and thank you for agreeing to be on. And I hope
and thank you for your questions and from the audience's questions. It was fun doing this.
Yeah. All right, Jeffrey. Well, I'll let you get to your next call. And for everybody else out there, thank you for listening in. And we'll post this on YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn.
Yep. And hopefully we'll get zillions of downloads, and hopefully at least somebody besides, you know, a relative will buy 7 Rules of Power.
They will. Jeffrey. All right. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.